Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And Fred and I were just talking about the cultural avoidance that some organizations have when it comes to engineering, and in particular, reliability engineering, for some reason.
I almost generalize this to just math. I mean, I've worked in organizations where it was just part and parcel of every day is you show the data, you show the formula, you show the derivation. And then other organizations where if you wanted to confuse the people to great extent and get whatever you want, just show them an integral, especially before 10 o'clock. We've talked about and certainly I've written about the maturity matrix for reliability types of stuff. And it's a cultural thing as to how you approach it. And the hard part I find is typified in if, use the example of we have a failure, right? Just something broke, failed, customer's complaining, whatever. We've got an identified failure. And then some cultures just go, all right, well, if we replace everything, it'll be good, right? And they call that failure analysis. And I'm like, wait a second, no. There's some engineering work here. What actually caused this thing? What's the chemical process that led to this corrosion? And what constituents were present or not present, and which ones are there by design, and which ones are added by some other phenomena? Let's think this through and actually do the work to go sort this thing out. You know, and that adds value. Where if just shotgunning it, we're going to see this problem again and again and again. But on the other end of the extreme is I was trying to explain a component derating to somebody the other day. And he says, oh, we just looked that up in a table. And it's for this type of component, it's the 50% of the voltage. And then we use that part. I'm like, well, what happens if you have to use the 60% derating or 40% derating? Well, we have to redesign then. We have to find another part. So why don't you do a little engineering and go figure out, well, what's the relationship of that stress to the failure mechanism? And there's probably a formula for that. Let's go sort that out. There's a relationship. Well, that's too hard. That takes too long. We don't do PhD theses here. I'm like, what? But you've run into other stuff. You were talking earlier about, you know, just like at military level that just people avoiding it. And
yeah, and I mean the trigger for that conversation was I'm thinking about applying to talk about this in greater detail to my old organization, the Australian Army. They have this thing called the Australian Army Research Scheme, where they ask, you know, a bunch of people, including ex-officers and people who were passionate and still involved in the big picture, to do a bit of research and put their thoughts on paper about what can be improved moving forward and what is going wrong. And, you know, as a reliability engineer, the first thing that sprung to mind was getting military equipment that not only can work, but equipment that will work. And when I say will work, we're talking about things that don't, where there's such a vicious focus on hunting failures that your supply chains are cut in half and you're able to deploy further and more easily because you don't need to take as many spare parts and you don't need to have as many maintainers, or the maintainers you do have, you really thought of that maintainability, so you only need to have a single wrench and minimize training, so you don't have to have three different types of technicians or tradesmen or craftsmen on hand. You make it simple to fix. That is the true cost of war. Fixing stuff.
The logistics is just a nightmare in many cases. It is. It's one of those where it's, well, we're going to hire somebody to do that work. And then we're going to hire somebody else to actually do the thinking behind that work. And then we'll hire somebody else that will, you know, four tiers away, that will actually do the formula or the calculations or whatever. And it just gets completely lost in the understanding of what it is we're trying to accomplish. It's just this, well, that's hard. I'm not going to do that kind of thing. We can hire somebody to go do that for us. But then there's two steps away from understanding what in the world the analysis is for.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I find it frustrating. I was listening to I've been driving all over the county, dropping off hazardous waste for cleaning out a house. And so I got a chance to listen to a bunch of these. They're called Great Lectures, or I think that's what the series is called, from Audible. And one of them was about this, you know, I don't remember what the specific topic was, but it was talking about, I'm drawing a blank. It wasn't Einstein, but it was somebody in his realm of the world. I want to say Rutherford or somebody like that. One of the great physicists type thing. No. It was more recent. It was Feynman, Richard Feynman.
Yep.
And one of the things that they mentioned that he did was he went straight to the back of the book where all the formula were and memorized those and really got to understand those things. But then he was able to go from industry to industry and then the lecture talked about other people that did that. And they were seen as odd because they knew a whole lot about, you know, optics, but the formula and the relationships and the patterns would show up in other fields. And they would have an intuitive understanding of it because they mastered the relationships, the interactions and how stress is applied and cause changes. And they could go from industry to industry and have great impact on those things. But the underlying trait this person was talking about is that if you understand the math, if you understand the patterns and the relationships, that you have a much keener insight to what the world is presenting to you, and you can see things that other people can't see. And I've run into this with trying to teach people how to do SPC. You know, here's the basic formulas. And if this goes up, that goes down, this makes this, you know, or sample size calculations. Well, this is why we have this many this sample size. Well, what if I want less confidence? Well, yeah, you can get fewer samples, but then you have a meaningless answer, you know, kind of thing. And it's right here in the formula. And they look at me with their eyes glazed over. You want me to look at a formula and see how do I interpret this? And I think the topic of it's cultural. If somebody says, show me the formula, let's work through this, and we both understand it, then it becomes natural that you have to talk about that and deal with it. That's where you start. I used to work for a boss that his mantra was, show me the data. I have a proposal, you know, Bill, I want to talk to you about. Show me the data. Show me the formula. Show me the calculations. And you just knew that that's what the question is going to be, so that's what you did. As opposed to an organization that says, show me the ROI. And they don't really care about the calculations and derivations of it. Oh, it's got an 18 ROI over 6 months. Oh, great. Let's do that. And they have no understanding of what the proposal is about. I'm ranting here. Sorry.
I mean, the people you're describing, if you go back a couple of rants, you're talking about people who essentially were asking questions about, well, how big the sample size need to be? Is this enough? This is this, so on and so forth. And those are people who are almost exclusively trying to put something on paper, which they can then say, well, that's my bit done.
Right.
The outcome is not trying to fix anything or solve anything. It's putting something on paper. And when I looked at this issue of cultural avoidance, and I had to do a bit of preparation for it, for thinking about this application, in my mind, there's three things that happens to allow cultural avoidance. And cultural avoidance isn't a conscious choice. It might be something that people do, even in a way know they're doing, but it's at best through an act of omission as opposed to an act of commission.
Mm-hmm.
But doesn't mean that cultural avoidance is not something which is celebrated, venerated, and supported in an organization, even if there's no committee saying we're going to avoid making tough decisions. If everyone knows what happens,
right. We're going to no integrals ever. We're an integral free, you know, algebra free.
Right.
I saw a quote the other day. It says, why would I ever want to learn algebra? It's not like I'm ever going to go there.
That's right. But in my mind, there's three parts that cultural avoidance needs to have. And the first one is defendability. The second one is decision and risk transferal. And the third one is no strategy. So what I mean by that is that people still need to do stuff where that if they're prompted or if they're asked by someone, hey, that reliability challenge, did you get on it? Yeah, I did. There's a report over there. There's my confidence bounds. There's mm-hmm. all those things that those people who are asking you about the sample size and the confidence and everything, they're those things that those people spat out. That they just put those things out there to defend their efforts, not mm-hmm. to solve anything, just to defend it. And the other second thing I often find is the decision and risk transferal. So you might have the CEO, director, or whoever's in charge and say, yeah, oh, the guy in charge of reliability is over there. He is that guy or she is that person that I have, you know, if they say it's okay, then it's okay. If they say it's not okay, then I'll go down there and talk them around until it is okay.
That's like, right. They're wrong. We'll have to fix that.
Yeah. You have this sort of, you outsource thinking. You might even outsource to a third party to build the thing in the first place, but you have these technical decision makers who when push comes to shove, they tend to be just people who have devolved into an auditor just to say, did we think about this? Did we think about that? Yes. Okay. It is reliable or not. So right. That's what I've seen, decision and risk transfer. And the last one is no strategy. So they either have a strategy statement, which is just meaningless with management gobbledygook, where you know, we're in the business where safety is number one and we every day we wake up and implore our employees to be outstanding in the field of magnificence on a 24/7 boat, or just meaningless babble.
Right. So,
how are you going about achieving this particular aspect of your thing? And there's none of it. They avoid it. They put posters up there, up on the walls, which with their faces on it saying, you know, we take this very seriously. It's very mm-hmm. important. But you can't find a document or a meeting or a person who will say, well, this is how we do it. So they're the three things I see. Have I missed anything or do you?
No, those are all good. And each one's bringing up, you know, elements that I'm sure I've mentioned this before on the show. Probably one of our discussions is that I was in a class that had all these senior execs coming into the class to talk about what they did, you know, it's procurement and legal and operations and all kinds of different VP level type people coming in. And one of them is talking pretty much that babble stuff. Oh, this is important, blah, blah, blah. And this is what I do. And this is how, you know, this is critical, vital, you know, essential, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, well, what you just talked about all these great, wonderful priorities. What's a typical day in your calendar look like? Yeah. Oh, I had a meeting about who gets to sit next to the window. We're, you know, negotiating a contract to outsource the travel agency. We're doing, you know, like, so in a typical day, you don't do anything that's related to what you just spent an hour telling us was important. And he looked at me like, that's not good, is it? Like, no, it's not. You know, so I was blacklisted immediately and told to go sit in the corner. But seriously, I asked every one of them after that. And finally, the word got around that I was going to ask this question. And one of them had a coherent, babble-ish type answer for what they did. And he says, really? Let's look at your calendar. So, well, no, you can't see my calendar. It's private. It's like, right, whatever. But it goes to that I like the deniability or CYA type behavior that people will take is as opposed to saying, well, here's our trade-offs. We have a decision to make. Here's the understanding of these relationships. And to me, that's engineering is we've got a beam. It's got to support this load. We can do the force strength analysis. We can do some experiments to support it and our assumptions. And we can do some calculations and some modeling and some simulation. And we can really understand it. Or we can say, well, you know, I'm just going to put a beam on there and we'll, you know, it should be good enough and we'll move on. neither one is the exact right approach, but it's that trigger of what are the critical things that we really do need to do the analysis for, and whether it's reliability or other places. And it gets reinforced by, well, what are the trade-offs? What are the weaknesses? What are the areas of, how do we know what we know? And what, you know, start challenging the engineering decisions and the trade-offs and the balances and the, what's the source of that formula? Why are you making that assumption? If those questions are asked, the culture is completely different. People start having to do the work, getting the book out, working through the thermodynamic set of equations and working out the mechanics of what's happening in a system. Whereas, oh, it'll be good, don't worry about it. We have to go with the cheaper vendor because that's what we do. And like, well, let's consider these trade-offs here. I think it's, to me, the culture comes from what is that cascade set of decisions and questions that are asked that shape how people behave. Unfortunately, is there's too many people that don't want to do the engineering, don't in themselves, and push it off. And that message gets translated as, well, engineering is not important.
Yeah, or you have a chief engineer and who becomes the oracle decision maker, and it's because the leaders, the true leaders of the organization, don't want to involve themselves. But we know we need to have an engineer, you know, involved with decision making to make something workable, not going to fall apart. So you often get these chief engineers or lead engineers, and especially in the militaries, the chief engineer then becomes the only decision maker. So if anything goes wrong, it's on that person's plate. And so that's a natural incentive to be risk averse. There's no, because they're a technical decision maker, because they're the oracle, whatever you want to call them, they're the chief technical decision maker. But the reality is they're not in the leadership team. So if they prescribe a bunch of different tests or things you need to do because they're risk averse in their decision making, the fact that that might delay a mission or perhaps delay a schedule doesn't matter to them because it's not in their remit. But because what you have done by making them the engineering oracle is saying your only concern is to make sure things don't go wrong. That's, I don't want to think about it. I've made you think about it. You're in charge of it. There you go. And then it has the counterproductive effect of, well, everything's important now. There's no balance. And then you have the leaders who get pissed off with the chief oracle decision maker. And they say, well, you're not involved. You don't wear it if this goes wrong. I do, but I don't want to think about it. It's your job. And it's just, you know, keep going around.
A recent startup I was working with in the last year or so, were amazing. Is the C-level folks, which were two of them, it's not a big company, their lead question on a review or, you know, how's it going with the stack up for the heat dissipation for this new device is, well, can you show me the simulations? Walk me through that. Is, you know, and it wasn't, what does that red button mean? You know, kind of thing. It was, they understood it. They had enough technical savvy that they could ask the right questions. They could understand even areas that weren't in their field. So they would bounce from mechanical, electrical, to thermal, and so on. And they got it. And they would ask the questions that drove the analysis in a way that valued, oh, I see that you put the mesh here and you're doing this, and this has given us this kind of precision on the answer, and there's a trade-off here, and how are we going to handle that? What are the options? They ask questions like that. And what's the underlying phenomena that's occurring here? Why does this area cause concern? You know, what is the understanding there? And then they would invest resources and provide the time so these guys could do the simulations. They could run the experiments. They could do stuff like that. So I don't think it's a cultural avoidance in places that don't value it. Like you said, it could be just an unstated lack of, everybody will say, oh yeah, we do great engineering. But do you really? Are you only asking questions about cost or time to market or whatever else? And and avoiding actually picking up a pencil and writing out an equation?
Yeah, and I think even something that an organization values might not be, and let's just talk simple, shareholder value, long-term mm-hmm. profitability. That might not be what the president or the CEO or whoever else values, especially if it's a toxic culture where you need to conform to a set of behaviors to get promoted, then conforming to that set of behaviors is what is valued in a professional social way. And that's what happens because all organizations are essentially how human beings interact with each other. And when the things that actually are valuable are not valued by the decision makers or aren't seen to be valuable by the decision makers, that's where you have problems. And then what you're talking about is a really good counterexample where you have the CEO or whoever it was saying, hey, I want you to walk me through that simulation,
right.
Which shows the employees that this is something I value. I want you to waste my time telling me about this simulation. That's how much I value it. If you keep asking it, when are we going to launch?
Right.
That's what becomes valuable. And then employees, human beings, I see it, they'll find a way to make the boss happy for their own personal reasons, which means cutting corners if necessary.
Yeah. Now, you know, it goes way beyond just the organizations trying to make things or this or that or that, you know, what we're talking about, whether it's a procurement organization in the military or a startup creating a new design. The engineering culture of an organization starts way before. I think in school, I'm just thinking is that I went to an engineering college, right? I went to a school that it was required to have an engineering degree. I was required to take a engineering track of one kind or another. So I took electrical engineering. There were not that many people in electrical engineering because they were perceived as difficult. Vast majority of people took civil engineering because they could get better grades there because it was simple. The overall campus perception of it was, which kind of gave me pause about the civil engineers in general. I know that there's some really good ones out there, but if the only ones going in that field are the ones thinking it's the simple one, heaven help us kind of thing. Mm. But and then physics and math majors, two other areas I studied, where progressively fewer and fewer people took those courses. And what struck me is like I'm in a junior level class in physics and there's three students. That's it, out of 2,000 classmates. But I go over to history or the civil engineering classes, and they're in amphitheaters. There's hundreds and hundreds in those classes. And I had to take some of the mainstream engineering classes. And one of them was a mechanics class that I had to take. The physics department did not recognize the mechanical engineering's class on mechanics. And so you had to take the one in physics to count towards my degree, my major. But I was required to take the one from the mechanics department. And the mechanics department guy prided himself in using different color chalk. The red was for acceleration, blue is for vectors, and white was for scalars. And he could pick the color chalk out of his hand without looking at it. That was his pride to existence, I think.
Okay.
And so they gave me a midterm, and he had draw over a bunch of formulas, and we got a little cheat sheet that listed, you know, like 20 or 30 different formulas. And the trick was to pick the right formula to solve the particular problem on the test. And then we called it plug and chug. You'd fill in the numbers and turn the crank. And if you did the math right, you got the right answer. Well, in the physics department, I'm taking mechanics, and it's, you know, pendulums and beams and stresses and stuff like that. And I was using Lagrange and Hamiltonian derivations to come up with the formula, which is the exact same thing this guy was doing with colored chalk without looking at the chalk on the board. So I didn't know which formula to use. So I started a Lagrange derivation for this particular problem, and I solved it, and I got the right answer. And I got 2 points for that problem out of the 25 points or whatever it was worth. So I failed the test. I'm like, wait a second. You only gave me the 2 points because I got the right answer. And he says, well, I don't understand what you did to solve this problem. I says, well, I did what you do on the board every day. I drove the equation. Well, that's not the problem. That wasn't the question. The question was, you're supposed to pick the right formula. So I took it to the department head and said, this is a problem. I got the right answer. Mm-hmm. And I did what he's showing us in class. And the professor's standing there saying, well, he didn't pick the formula off the cheat sheet. And he looked at it and I think he would have fired him on the spot, except that he was tenured.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing. And I think part of it is that if you, well, the tenure, yeah, it was a problem, but it was the idea is that, are you trying to teach me the shortcut or are you trying to teach me understanding? And it starts in classes that we get taught the compliance to pass the test. And here's the textbook open to page 68 and you have an answer without the understanding of why page 68 exists.
Mm-hmm. It all comes down to what you value. And, yep. And it's really simple. I think engineers across the world, if an organization says, hey, we are here to make stuff that lasts a long time, that's a challenge engineers can really understand.
Yep.
It's not like engineers all of a sudden genetically been modified of late to not worry about making things robust and last a long time. If you say this is an engineering challenge to make it last a long time, it becomes like every other engineering challenge. I just don't see how it's a product of young people's minds. It's, if it's anything, it's going to be, you know, your tenured professors crushing lateral thinking or critical thinking. But going back to defendability, I think one thing that I've talked about for cultural avoidance, one of the things I always see when people wanted, they're not interested in getting the right answer, they're not interested in informing a decision, they're not interested in making the organization better. They're interested in doing something so that if someone comes back and in the event of a catastrophe says, well, show me how you did your job, well, here's my report I wrote. It, the next step beyond that in a preemptive perspective is to create a crushing bureaucracy where this is how we do this. This is the test we need to pass. This is the equations we need to use. And then you can audit the bureaucracy beforehand to get someone to say, yes, you have clearly thought this through. So you can say, we're good.
No more thinking required.
That's right. Because you want to defend. You don't want to answer the question. You want to defend. So you have bureaucracy, and the militaries are a great case in point. They keep having these horrible acquisitions after horrible acquisitions. And the answer isn't, hey, we need to reinvigorate the engineering training, or hey, we need to do this, or we need to really reinvigorate our culture when it comes to interacting with contractors and telling them what's valuable and expressing what's valuable. No, the reviews always come back to, well, here is a revised process. Here are the 75 new steps we need to incorporate to check mm-hmm. the contractor's doing the right thing. And we get this crushing bureaucracy where that becomes valuable. And I think I was telling you, I was speaking with a colleague who's still in the Australian Army. He's been promoted to colonel. He's talking about how in the organization he's about to walk into, they spend 2 days out of every week preparing the weekly brief, which is a monstrosity of a PowerPoint presentation with microscopic dot points and lists and everything else. Just stuff you cannot possibly even hope to retain if you're the poor sap watching this nonsense. But if that's what they do, if the boss says, hey, I like this weekly brief, and it takes two days out of every week to make it happen, then that is the thing that becomes valuable. And you know why they're doing it, because the boss wants to, they're nervous. They got no idea what's going on. They need to have someone tell them that it's okay with this monstrosity of a PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah.
And they don't want to miss anything, so they have to have every single point included because it needs to be in there so they can defend something happening in the future. So no, boss, I told you it's on slide 335 at the bottom right hand corner down there. And it just becomes the bureaucracy, the process becomes the god of everything, and engineering loses. It just happens all the time.
Well, I think we hit a handful of different salient points, and that I tried to throw in a couple of good examples of that it can be beat, and it does exist. Good engineering does and can thrive in appropriate cultures, but it does have a number of barriers. I think we're also touching on another topic here, which we'll have to come back and talk about.
Yes.
Setting up that bureaucracy reminded me of that. That's a whole nother topic. Let's cut this one off here and say, you know, we framed this one, and hopefully the audience here at Ascendo really, really likes engineering. I think that's what we do. It's part of our titles, and for many of us, but it's a self-selected application. And so what kind of barriers are you seeing? What kind of culture do you live in? And are you doing engineering to help in improve things or not? You don't have to tell us if you're not doing it then. But give us some good examples. We'd appreciate that. Over at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR is a great way to get in touch with us. Or you can find Chris or I on LinkedIn or on the About pages at Ascendo. And we sincerely look forward to hearing from you. A good number of questions and topics that we talk about on the show are obviously from our listeners. And so we look forward to having you join the conversation. So with that, Chris, I think we'll wrap this one up.
Fantastic. Thanks for your time, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.